small shutter, and the wide door slid open rapidly. The temperature dropped at once, and Selden thrust his hands into his pockets and was very glad he had a sweater on. A cold wind stirred his hair, and it occurred to him that he would have found a hat useful. And even as he thought that, Lagan pulled something out of a fold in his sweater, snapped it open, and put it on his head. The others did the same. Only Clausia hesitated. She paused just before she put hers on, then offered it to Selden. Selden shook his head. "I can't take your hat, Clausia."
"Go ahead. I have long hair, and it's pretty thick. Yours is short and a little thin."
Selden would have liked to deny that firmly, and at another time he would have. Now, however, he took the hat and mumbled, "Thank you. If your head gets cold, I'll give it back." Maybe she wasn't so young. It was her round face, almost a baby face. And now that she had called attention to her hair, he could see that it was a charming russet shade. He had never seen hair quite like that on Helicon. Outside it was cloudy, as it had been the time he was taken across open country to the palace. It was considerably colder than it had been then, but he assumed that was because they were 6 weeks farther into winter. The clouds were thicker than they had been on the earlier occasion, and the day was distinctly darker and threatening. Or was it just closer to night? Surely they wouldn't come up to do important work without leaving themselves an ample period of daylight to do it in. Or did they expect to take very little time? He would have liked to have asked, but it occurred to him that they might not like questions at this time. All of them seemed to be in states varying from excitement to anger. Selden inspected his surroundings. He was standing on something that he thought might be dull metal from the sound it made when he surreptitiously thumped his foot down on it. It was not bare metal, however. When he walked, he left footprints. The surface was clearly covered by dust or fine sand or clay. Well, why not? There could scarcely be anyone coming up here to dust the place. He bent down to pinch up some of the matter out of curiosity. Clausia had come up to him. She noticed what he was doing and said, with the air of a housewife caught in an embarrassing negligence,
"We do sweep hereabouts for the sake of the instruments. It's much worse most places, Upperside, but it really doesn't matter. It makes for insulation, you know."
Selden grunted and continued to look about. There was no chance of understanding the instruments that looked as though they were growing out of the thin soil, if one could call it that. He hadn't the faintest idea of what they were or what they measured. Lagan was walking toward him. He was picking up his feet and putting them down gingerly, and it occurred to Selden that he was doing so to avoid jarring the instruments. He made a mental note to walk that way himself.
"You, Selden."
Selden didn't quite like the tone of voice. He replied coolly, "Yes, Dr. Lagan."
"Well, Dr. Selden, then," he said it impatiently. "That little fellow Rhonda told me you were a mathematician."
"That's right."
"A good one."
"I'd like to think so, but it's a hard thing to guarantee."
"And you're interested in intractable problems?"
Selden said feelingly, "I'm stuck with one."
"I'm stuck with another. You're free to look about. If you have any questions, our intern Clausia will help out. You might be able to help us."
"I would be delighted to, but I know nothing about meteorology."
"That's all right, Selden. I just want you to get a feel for this thing. And then I'd like to discuss my mathematics, such as it is."
"I'm at your service." Lagan turned away, his long, scowling face looking grim. Then he turned back.
If you get cold, too cold, the elevator door is open. You just step in and touch the spot marked University Base. It will take you down, and the elevator will then return to us automatically. Clausia will show you if you forget.
I won't forget. This time he did leave, and Selden looked after him, feeling the cold wind knife through his sweater. Clausia came back over to him, her face slightly reddened by that wind.
Selden said, Dr. Lagan seems annoyed, or is that just his ordinary outlook on life?
She giggled.
He does look annoyed most of the time, but right now he really is.
Selden said very naturally, Why?
Clausia looked over her shoulder, her long hair swirling. Then she said, I'm not supposed to know, but I do just the same. Dr. Lagan had it all figured out that today, just at this time, there was going to be a break in the clouds, and he'd been planning to make special measurements in sunlight. Only, well, look at the weather.
Selden nodded.
We have holovision receivers up here, so we knew it was cloudy, worse than usual. And I guess he was hoping there would be something wrong with the instruments so that it would be their fault and not that of his theory. So far, though, they haven't found anything out of the way.
And that's why he looks so unhappy.
Well, he never looks happy.
Selden looked about, squinting. Despite the clouds, the light was harsh. He became aware that the surface under his feet was not quite horizontal. He was standing on a shallow dome, and as he looked outward there were other domes in all directions, with different widths and heights.
Upper side seems to be irregular, he said.
Mostly, I think, that's the way it worked out.
Any reason for it?
Not really. The way I've heard it explained, I looked around and asked, just as you did, you know, was that originally the people on Trantor domed in places, shopping malls, sports arenas, things like that, then whole towns, so that there were lots of domes here and there with different heights and different widths. When they all came together, it was all uneven, but by that time, people decided that's the way it ought to be.
You mean that something quite accidental came to be viewed as a tradition?
I suppose so, if you want to put it that way.
If something quite accidental can easily become viewed as a tradition and be made unbreakable or nearly so, thought Selden, would that be a law of psychohistory? It sounded trivial, but how many other laws equally trivial might there be? A million? A billion? Were there a relatively few general laws from which these trivial ones could be derived as corollaries? How could he say? For a while, lost in thought, he almost forgot the biting wind. Clausia was aware of that wind, however, for she shuddered and said,
It's very nasty. It's much better under the dome.
Are you a Trantorian? Asked Selden.
That's right.
Selden remembered Rhonda's dismissal of Trantorians as agoraphobic and said, Do you mind being up here?
I hate it, said Clausia. But I want my degree and my specialty and status, and Dr. Lagan says I can't get it without some field work. So here I am, hating it, especially when it's so cold. When it's this cold, by the way, you wouldn't dream that vegetation actually grows on these domes, would you?
It does? He looked at Clausia sharply, suspecting some sort of practical joke designed to make him look foolish. She looked totally innocent, but how much of that was real, and how much was just her baby face?
Oh, sure. even here when it's warmer. You notice the soil here? We keep it swept away because of our work, as I said. But in other places, it accumulates here and there, and is especially deep in the low places where the domes meet. Plants grow in it.
But where does the soil come from?
When the domes covered just part of the planet, the wind deposited soil on them, little by little. Then, when Trantor was all covered, and the living levels were dug deeper and deeper, some of the material dug up, if suitable, would be spread over the top.
Surely it would break down the domes.
Oh, no. The domes are very strong, and they're supported almost everywhere. The idea was, according to a book film I viewed, that they were going to grow crops upperside. But it turned out to be much more practical to do it inside the dome. Yeast and algae could be cultivated within the domes, too, taking the pressure off the usual crops, so it was decided to let upperside go wild. There are animals on upperside, too. Butterflies, bees, mice, rabbits, lots of them.
Won't the plant roots damage the domes?
In thousands of years they haven't. The domes are treated so that they repel the roots. Most of the growth is grass, but there are trees, too. You'd be able to see for yourself if this were the warm season, or if we were farther south, or if you were up in a spaceship.
She looked at him with a sidewise flick of her eyes.
Did you see Trantor when you were coming down from space?
No, Clausia, I must confess I didn't. The hypership was never well placed for viewing. Have you ever seen Trantor from space? She smiled weakly.
I've never been in space.
Selden looked about, gray everywhere. I can't make myself believe it, he said. About vegetation upperside, I mean.
It's true, though. I've heard people say, otherworlders like yourself, who did see Trantor from space, that the planet looks green, like a lawn, because it's mostly grass and underbrush. There are trees, too, actually. There's a copse not very far from here. I've seen it. They're evergreens, and they're up to 6 meters high.
Where?
You can't see it from here. It's on the other side of a dome. It's...
The call came out thinly. Selden realized they had been walking while they had been talking, and had moved away from the immediate vicinity of the others.
Clausia, get back here. We need you.
Clausia said, Oh, coming. Sorry, Dr. Selden, I have to go.
She ran off, managing to step lightly despite her lined boots. Had she been playing with him? Had she been filling the gullible foreigner with a mess of lies for amusement's sake? Such things had been known to happen on every world and in every time. An air of transparent honesty was no guide either. In fact, successful tale-tellers would deliberately cultivate just such an air. So could there really be 6-meter trees upperside? Without thinking much about it, he moved in the direction of the highest dome on the horizon. He swung his arms in an attempt to warm himself, and his feet were getting cold. Clausia hadn't pointed. She might have, to give him a hint of the direction of the trees, but she didn't. Why didn't she? To be sure, she had been called away. The domes were broad rather than high, which was a good thing, since otherwise the going would have been considerably more difficult. On the other hand, the gentle grade meant trudging a distance before he could top a dome and look down the other side. Eventually, he could see the other side of the dome he had climbed. He looked back to make sure he could still see the meteorologists and their instruments. They were a good way off, in a distant valley, but he could see them clearly enough. Good. He saw no cops, no trees, but there was a depression that snaked about between two domes. Along each side of that crease, the soil was thicker, and there were occasional green smears of what might be moss. If he followed the crease, and if it got low enough, and the soil was thick enough, there might be trees. He looked back, trying to fix landmarks in his mind, but there were just the rise and fall of domes. It made him hesitate, and Dorr's warning against his being lost, which had seemed a rather unnecessary piece of advice then, made more sense now. Still, it seemed clear to him that the crease was a kind of road. If he followed it for some distance, he had only to turn about and follow it back to return to this spot. He strode off purposefully, following the rounded crease downward. There was a soft rumbling noise above, but he didn't give it any thought. He had made up his mind that he wanted to see trees, and that was all that occupied him at the moment. The moss grew thicker and spread out like a carpet, and here and there grassy tufts had sprung up. Despite the desolation upperside, the moss was bright green, and it occurred to Selden that on a cloudy, overcast planet there was likely to be considerable rain. The crease continued to curve, and there, just above another dome, was a dark smudge against the gray sky, and he knew he had found the trees. Then, as though his mind, having been liberated by the sight of those trees, could turn to other things, Selden took note of the rumble he had heard before, and had, without thinking, dismissed as the sound of machinery. Now he considered that possibility. Was it indeed the sound of machinery? Why not? He was standing on one of the myriad domes that covered hundreds of millions of square kilometers of the world city. There must be machinery of all kinds hidden under those domes. Ventilation motors, for one thing. Maybe it could be heard, where and when all the other sounds of the world city were absent. Except that it did not seem to come from the ground. He looked up at the dreary, featureless sky. Nothing. He continued to scan the sky, vertical creases appearing between his eyes, and then, far off. It was a small, dark spot showing up against the gray, and whatever it was, it seemed to be moving about as though getting its bearings before it was obscured by the clouds again. Then, without knowing why, he thought, "They're after me." And almost before he could work out a line of action, he had taken one. He ran desperately along the crease toward the trees, and then, to reach them more quickly, he turned left and hurtled up and over a low dome, treading through brown and dying fern-like overgrowth, including thorny sprigs with bright red berries. Selden panted, facing a tree, holding it closely, embracing it. He watched for the flying object to make its appearance again, so that he could back about the tree and hide on the far side like a squirrel. The tree was cold, its bark was rough, it gave no comfort, but it offered cover. Of course, that might be insufficient if he was being searched for with a heat-seeker, but on the other hand, the cold trunk of a tree might blur even that. Below him was hard-packed soil. Even in this moment of hiding, of attempting to see his pursuer while remaining unseen, he could not help wondering how thick the soil might be, how long it had taken to accumulate. How many domes in the warmer areas of Trantor carried forests on their back? And whether the trees were always confined to the creases between domes, leaving the higher regions to moss, grass, and underbrush.
He saw it again. It was not a hypership, nor even an ordinary airjet. It was a jet down. He could see the faint glow of the ion trails coming out at the vertices of a hexagon, neutralizing the gravitational pull and allowing the wings to keep it aloft like a large soaring bird. It was a vehicle that could hover and explore a planetary terrain. It was only the clouds that had saved him. Even if they were using heat seekers, that would only indicate there were people below. The jet down would have to make a tentative dive below the banked ceiling before it could hope to know how many human beings there were and whether any of them might be the particular person the parties aboard were seeking. The jet down was closer now, but it couldn't hide from him either. The rumble of the engine gave it away, and they couldn't turn that off, not as long as they wished to continue their search. Selden knew the jetdowns, for on Helicon or on any undomed world with skies that cleared now and then, they were common, with many in private hands. Of what possible use would jetdowns be on Trentor, with all the human life of the world under domes, with low cloud ceilings all but perpetual, except for a few government vehicles designed for just this purpose, that of picking up a wanted person who had been lured above the domes? Why not? Government forces could not enter the grounds of the university, but perhaps Selden was no longer on the grounds. He was on top of the domes, which might be outside the jurisdiction of any local government. An imperial vehicle might have every right to land on any part of the dome and question or remove any person found upon it. Hummon had not warned him of this, but perhaps he had merely not thought of doing so. The jetdown was even closer now, nosing about like a blind beast sniffing out its prey. Would it occur to them to search this group of trees? The jetdown was even closer now, nosing about like a blind beast sniffing out its prey. Would it occur to them to search this group of trees? Would they land and send out an armed soldier or two to beat through the copse? And if so, what could he do? He was unarmed, and all his quick-twist agility would be useless against the agonizing pain of a neuronic whip. It was not attempting to land. Either they missed the significance of the trees, or a new thought suddenly hit him. What if this wasn't a pursuit vessel at all? What if it was part of the meteorological testing? Surely meteorologists would want to test the upper reaches of the atmosphere. Was he a fool to hide from it? The sky was getting darker. The clouds were getting thicker. Or, much more likely, night was falling. And it was getting colder, and would get colder still. Was he going to stay out here freezing because a perfectly harmless jetdown had made an appearance and had activated a sense of paranoia that he had never felt before? He had a strong impulse to leave the copse and get back to the meteorological station. After all, how would the man Hummon feared so much, Demerzel, know that Selden would at this particular time be upperside and ready to be taken? For a moment that seemed conclusive, and shivering with the cold, he moved out from behind the tree. And then he scurried back as the vessel reappeared even closer than before. He hadn't seen it do anything that would seem to be meteorological. It did nothing that might be considered sampling, measuring, or testing. Would he see such things if they took place? He did not know the precise sort of instruments the jetdown carried or how they worked. If they were doing meteorological work, he might not be able to tell. Still, could he take the chance of coming into the open? After all, what if Demerzel did know of his presence upperside, simply because an agent of his working in the university knew about it and had reported the matter? Lisung Randa,
that cheerful, smiling little Easterner had suggested he go Upperside. He had suggested it quite forcefully, and the subject had not arisen naturally out of the conversation, at least not naturally enough. Was it possible that he was a government agent and had alerted Demerzel somehow? Then there was Legan, who had given him the sweater. The sweater was useful, but why hadn't Legan told him he would need one earlier so he could get his own? Was there something special about the one he was wearing? It was uniformly purple, while all the others indulged in the Trantorian fashion of bright patterns. Anyone looking down from a height would see a moving dull blotch in among others that were bright, and know immediately whom they wanted. And Clausia? She was supposedly Upperside to learn meteorology and help the meteorologists. How was it possible that she could come to him, talk to him at ease, and quietly walk him away from the others, and isolate him so that he could easily be picked up? For that matter, what about Doris Van Ebele? She knew he was going Upperside. She did not stop it. She might have gone with him, but she was conveniently busy. It was a conspiracy. Surely it was a conspiracy. He had convinced himself now, and there was no further thought of getting out from the shelter of the trees. His feet felt like lumps of ice, and stamping them against the ground seemed to do no good. Would the jet down never leave? And even as he thought that, the pitch of the engine's rumble heightened, and the jet down rose into the clouds and faded away. Selden listened eagerly, alert to the smallest sound, making sure it was finally gone. And then, even after he was sure it was gone, he wondered if that was just a device to flush him out of hiding. He remained where he was, while the minutes slowly crawled on, and night continued to fall. And finally, when he felt that the true alternative to taking the chance of coming out in the open was that of freezing into insensibility, he stepped out and moved cautiously beyond the shelter of the trees. It was dusky twilight after all. They couldn't detect him except by a heat-seeker, but if so, he would hear the jet-down return. He waited just beyond the trees, counting to himself, ready to hide in the copse again at the smallest sound. Though what good that would do him once he was spotted, he couldn't imagine. Selden looked about. If he could find the meteorologists, they would surely have artificial light. But except for that, there would be nothing. He could still just make out his surroundings, but in a matter of a quarter of an hour, half an hour at the outside, he would not. With no lights and a cloudy sky above, it would be dark, completely dark. Desperate at the prospect of being enveloped in total darkness, Selden realized that he would have to find his way back to the crease that had brought him there as quickly as possible and retrace his steps. Folding his arms tightly around himself for warmth, he set off in what he thought was the direction of the crease between the domes. There might, of course, be more than one crease leading away from the copse, but he dimly made out some of the sprigs of berries he had seen coming in, which now looked almost black rather than bright red. He could not delay. He had to assume he was right. He moved up the crease as fast as he might, guided by failing sight and by the vegetation underfoot. But he couldn't stay in the crease forever. He had come over what had seemed to him to be the tallest dome in sight, and had found a crease that cut at right angles across his line of approach. By his reckoning, he should now turn right, then sharp left, and that would put him on the path toward the meteorologist's dome. Selden made the left turn, and lifting his head, he could just make out the curve of a dome against the fractionally lighter sky. That had to be it. Or was that only wishful thinking? He had no choice but to assume it wasn't. Keeping his eye on the peak so that he could move in a reasonably straight line, he headed for it as quickly as he could. As he got closer, he could make out the line of dome against sky with less and less certainty as it loomed larger and larger. Soon, if he was correct, he would be going up a gentle slope. And when that slope became level, he would be able to look down the other side and see the lights of the meteorologists. In the inky dark, he could not tell what lay in his path. Wishing there were at least a few stars to shed some light, he wondered if this was how it felt to be blind. He waved his arms before him as if they were antennae. It was growing colder by the minute, and he paused occasionally to blow on his hands and hold them under his armpits. He wished earnestly he could do the same for his feet. By now, he thought, if it started to precipitate, it would be snow, or, worse yet, sleet. On. On. There was nothing else to do. Eventually, it seemed to him that he was moving downward. That was either wishful thinking, or he had topped the dome. He stopped. If he had topped the dome, he should be able to see the artificial light of the meteorological station. He would see the lights carried by the meteorologists themselves, sparkling or dancing like fireflies. Selden closed his eyes as though to accustom them to dark, and then try again. But that was a foolish effort. It was no darker with his eyes closed than with them open. And when he opened them, it was no lighter than when he had had them closed. Possibly, Lagan and the others were gone, had taken their lights with them, and had turned off any lights on the instruments. Or possibly, Selden had climbed the wrong dome. Or he had followed a curved path along the dome, so that he was now facing in the wrong direction. Or he had followed the wrong crease, and had moved away from the cops in the wrong direction altogether. What should he do? If he was facing the wrong direction, there was a chance that light would be visible right or left. And it wasn't. If he had followed the wrong crease, there was no possible way he could return to the cops and locate a different crease. His only chance lay in the assumption that he was facing the right direction, and that the meteorological station was more or less directly ahead of him, but that the meteorologists had gone and had left it in darkness. Move forward, then. The chances of success might be small, but it was the only chance he had. He estimated that it had taken him half an hour to move from the meteorological station to the top of the dome, having gone partway with Clausia, and sauntering with her rather than striding. He was moving at little better than a saunter now in the daunting darkness. Selden continued to slog forward. It would have been nice to know the time, and he had a time band, of course, but in the dark. He stopped. He wore a Trantorian time band, which gave galactic standard time, as all time bands did, and which also gave Trantorian local time. Time bands were usually visible in the dark, phosphorescing so that one could tell time in the quiet dark of a bedchamber. A Heliconian time band certainly would. Why not a Trantorian one? He looked at his time band with reluctant apprehension and touched the contact that would draw upon the power source for light. The time band gleamed feebly and told him the time was 1847. For it to be nighttime already, Selden knew that it must be the winter season. How far past the solstice was it? What was the degree of axial tipping? How long was the year? How far from the equator was he at this moment? There was no hint of an answer to any of these things, but what counted was that the spark of light was visible. He was not blind. Somehow, the feeble glow of his time band gave him renewed hope. His spirits rose. He would move on in the direction he was going. He would move for half an hour. If he encountered nothing, he would move on 5 minutes more. No further, just 5 minutes. If he still encountered nothing, he would stop and think. That, however, would be 35 minutes from now. Till then, he would concentrate only on walking and on willing himself to feel warmer. He wiggled his toes vigorously. He could still feel them. Selden trudged onward, and the half hour passed. He paused. Then, hesitantly, he moved on for 5 more minutes. Now he had to decide. There was nothing. He might be nowhere, far removed from any opening into the dome. He might, on the other hand, be standing 3 meters to the left, or right, or short of the meteorological station. He might be 2 arms' lengths from the opening into the dome, which would not, however, be open. Now what? Was there any point in shouting? He was enveloped by utter silence, but for the whistling of the wind. If there were birds, beasts, or insects in among the vegetation on the domes, they were not here during this season, or at this time of night, or at this particular place. The wind continued to chill him. Perhaps he should have been shouting all the way. The sound might have carried a good distance in the cold air. But would there have been anyone to hear him? Would they hear him inside the dome? Were there instruments to detect sound or movement from above? Might there not be sentinels just inside? That seemed ridiculous. They would have heard his footsteps, wouldn't they? Still, he called out, "Help! Help! Can someone hear me?" His cry was strangled, half embarrassed. It seemed silly, shouting into vast black nothingness. But then he felt it was even sillier to hesitate in such a situation as this. Panic was welling up in him. He took in a deep, cold breath and screamed for as long as he could. Another breath, and another scream, changing pitch. And another. Selden paused, breathless, turning his head every which way, even though there was nothing to see. He could not even detect an echo. There was nothing left to do but wait for the dawn. But how long was the night at this season of the year, and how cold would it get? He felt a tiny, cold touch sting his face. After a while, another. It was sleeting invisibly in the pitch blackness, and there was no way to find shelter. He thought, it would have been better if that jet down had seen me and picked me up. I would be a prisoner at this moment, perhaps, but I'd be warm and comfortable at least. Or, if Hammond had never interfered, I might have been back in Helicon long ago, under surveillance, but warm and comfortable. Right now, that was all he wanted, to be warm and comfortable. But at the moment, he could only wait. He huddled down, knowing that however long the night, he dared not sleep. He slipped off his shoes and rubbed his icy feet. Quickly, he put his shoes back on. He knew he would have to repeat this, as well as rubbing his hands and ears all night long to keep his circulation flowing. But most important to remember was that he must not let himself fall asleep. That would mean certain death. And, having carefully thought all this out, his eyes closed, and he nodded off to sleep, with the sleet coming down. Rescue. Ligon Jannar. His contributions to meteorology, however, although considerable, pale before what has ever since been known as the Ligon controversy. That his actions helped to place Harry Selden in jeopardy is undisputable, but argument rages, and has always raged, as to whether those actions were the result of unintentional circumstance or part of a deliberate conspiracy. Passions have been raised on both sides, and even the most elaborate studies have come to no definite conclusions. Nevertheless, the suspicions that were raised helped poison Legan's career and private life in the years that followed. Encyclopedia Galactica. 25. It was not quite the end of daylight when Doris Van Abele sought out Jannar Legan. He answered her rather anxious greeting with a grunt and a brief nod.
"Will," she said a trifle impatiently, "how was he?"
Legan, who was entering data into his computer, said,
"How was who?"
"My library student, Harry. Dr. Harry Selden. He went up with you. Was he any help to you?"
Legan removed his hands from the keys of his computer and swiveled about.
"That Heliconian fellow? He was of no use at all. Showed no interest whatever. He kept looking at the scenery when there was no scenery to look at. A real oddball. Why did you want to send him up?"
"It wasn't my idea. He wanted to. I can't understand it. He was very interested. Where is he now?"
Legan shrugged.
"How would I know? Somewhere around."
"Where did he go after he came down with you? Did he say?"
"He didn't come down with us. I told you, he wasn't interested."
"Then when did he come down?"
"I don't know. I wasn't watching him. I had an enormous amount of work to do. There must have been a windstorm and some sort of downpour about 2 days ago, and neither was expected. Nothing our instrument showed offered a good explanation for it, or for the fact that some sunshine we were expecting today didn't appear. Now I'm trying to make sense of it, and you're bothering me."
"You mean you didn't see him go down?"
"Look, he wasn't on my mind. The idiot wasn't correctly dressed, and I could see that inside of half an hour he wasn't going to be able to take the cold. I gave him a sweater, but that wasn't going to help much for his legs and feet. So I left the elevator open for him, and I told him how to use it, and explained that it would take him down and then return automatically. It was all very simple, and I'm sure he did get cold, and he did go down, and the elevator did come back, and then eventually we all went down."
"But you don't know exactly when he went down."
"No, I don't. I told you, I was busy. He certainly wasn't up there when we left, though, and by that time twilight was coming on, and it looked as though it might sleet. So he had to have gone down."
"Did anyone else see him go down?"
"I don't know. Clausia may have. She was with him for a while. Why don't you ask her?"
Doris found Clausia in her quarters, just emerging from a hot shower.
"It was cold up there," she said.
Doris said, "Were you with Harry Selden, upper side?" Clausia said, eyebrows lifting,
"Yes, for a while. He wanted to wander about and ask questions about the vegetation up there. He's a sharp fellow, Doris. Everything seemed to interest him. So I told him what I could till Legan called me back. He was in one of his knock-your-head-off tempers. The weather wasn't working, and he..."
Doris interrupted.
"Then you didn't see Harry go down in the elevator?" "I didn't see him at all after Legan called me over. But he has to be down here. He wasn't up there when we left." "But I can't find him anywhere."
Clausia looked perturbed.
"Really? But he's got to be somewhere down here."
"No, he doesn't have to be somewhere down here," said Doris, her anxiety growing.
"What if he's still up there?" "That's impossible. He wasn't. Naturally, we looked about for him before we left. Flagon had shown him how to go down. He wasn't properly dressed, and it was rotten weather. Flagon told him if he got cold, not to wait for us. He was getting cold, I know. So what else could he do but go down?
But no one saw him go down. Did anything go wrong with him up there?
Nothing. Not while I was with him. He was perfectly fine, except that he had to be cold, of course.
Doors, by now quite unsettled, said, "Since no one saw him go down, he might still be up there. Shouldn't we go up and look?"
Clausius said nervously, "I told you, we looked around before we went down. It was still quite light, and he was nowhere in sight."
"Let's look anyway."
"But I can't take you up there. I'm just an intern, and I don't have the combination for the upper side dome opening. You'll have to ask Dr. Flagon."
26. Doris Van Ebbele knew that Flagon would not willingly go upper side now. He would have to be forced. First, she checked the library and the dining areas again. Then she called Selden's room. Finally, she went up there and signaled at the door. When Selden did not respond, she had the floor manager open it. He wasn't there. She questioned some of those who, over the last few weeks, had come to know him. No one had seen him. Well, then, she would make Flagon take her upper side. By now, though, it was night. He would object strenuously. And how long could she spend arguing if Harry Selden was trapped up there on a freezing night with sleet turning to snow? A thought occurred to her, and she rushed to the small university computer, which kept track of the doings of the students, faculty, and service staff. Her fingers flew over the keys, and she soon had what she wanted. There were three of them in another part of the campus. She signed out for a small glide cart to take her over and found the domicile she was looking for. Surely, one of them would be available, or findable. Fortune was with her. The first door at which she signaled was answered by a query light. She punched in her identification number, which included her department affiliation. The door opened, and a plump, middle-aged man stared out at her. He had obviously been washing up before dinner. His dark blonde hair was askew, and he was not wearing any upper garment. He said, "Sorry, you catch me at a disadvantage. What can I do for you, Dr. Van Ebbele?" She said a bit breathlessly, "You're Rogan Banastra, the chief seismologist, aren't you?"
"Yes."
"This is an emergency. I must see the seismological records for Upperside for the last few hours."
Banastra stared at her. "Why? Nothing's happened. I'd know if it had. The seismograph would inform us."
"I'm not talking about a meteoric impact."
"Neither am I. We don't need a seismograph for that. I'm talking about gravel, pinpoint fractures. Nothing today."
"Not that either. Please, take me to the seismograph and read it for me. This is life or death."
"I have a dinner appointment."
"I said life or death, and I mean it."
Banastra said, "I don't see..." But he faded out under Dora's glare. He wiped his face, left quick word on his message relay, and struggled into a shirt. They half ran, under Dora's pitiless urging, to the small, squat seismology building. Dora's, who knew nothing about seismology, said,
"Down? We're going down?"
"Below the inhabited levels, of course. The seismograph has to be fixed to bedrock and be removed from the constant clamor and vibration of the city levels."
"But how can you tell what's happening upperside from down here?"
The seismograph is wired to a set of pressure transducers located within the thickness of the dome. The impact of a speck of grit will send the indicator skittering off the screen. We can detect the flattening effect on the dome of a high wind. We can...
Yes, yes, said Doris impatiently.
She was not here for a lecture on the virtues and refinements of the instruments.
Can you detect human footsteps?
Human footsteps? Banastra looked confused. That's not likely, Upper Side.
Of course it's likely. There were a group of meteorologists Upper Side this afternoon.
Oh, well, footsteps would scarcely be noticeable.
It would be noticeable if you looked hard enough, and that's what I want you to do.
Banastra might have resented the firm note of command in her voice, but if so, he said nothing. He touched a contact, and the computer screen jumped to life. At the extreme right center, there was a fat spot of light, from which a thin horizontal line stretched to the left limit of the screen. There was a tiny wriggle to it, a random, non-repetitive series of little hiccups, and these moved steadily leftward. It was almost hypnotic in its effect on Doris. Banastra said, "That's as quiet as it can possibly be. Anything you see is the result of changing air pressure above. Raindrops, maybe. The distant whir of machinery. There's nothing up there."
All right, but what about a few hours ago? Check on the records at 1500 today, for instance. Surely you have some recordings.
Banastra gave the computer its necessary instructions, and for a second or two there was wild chaos on the screen. Then it settled down, and again the horizontal line appeared.
"I'll sensitize it to maximum," muttered Banastra.
There were now pronounced hiccups, and as they staggered leftward, they changed in pattern markedly.
"What's that?" said Doris. "Tell me."
"Since you say there were people up there, Venabili, I would guess they were footsteps, the shifting of weight, the impact of shoes. I don't know that I would have guessed it if I hadn't known about the people up there. It's what we call a benign vibration, not associated with anything we know to be dangerous."
"Can you tell how many people are present?"
"Certainly not by eye. You see, we're getting a resultant of all the impacts."
"You say, not by eye. Can the resultant be analyzed into its components by the computer?"
"I doubt it. These are minimal effects, and you have to allow for the inevitable noise. The results would be untrustworthy."
"Well then, move the time forward till the footstep indications stop. Can you make it fast forward, so to speak?"
"If I do, the kind of fast forward you're speaking of, then it will all just blur into a straight line with a slight haze above and below. What I can do is move it forward in 15-minute stages and study it quickly before moving on."
"Good. Do that."
Both watched the screen until Banastra said, "There's nothing there now, see?" There was again a line with nothing but tiny, uneven hiccups of noise.
"When did the footsteps stop?"
2 hours ago, a trifle more."
"And when they stopped, were there fewer than there were earlier?"
Banastra looked mildly outraged.
"I couldn't tell. I don't think the finest analysis could make a certain decision."
Doris pressed her lips together. Then she said,
"Are you testing a transducer, is that what you called it, near the meteorological outlet?"
"Yes. That's where the instruments are, and that's where the meteorologist would have been."
Then, unbelievingly, "Do you want me to try others in the vicinity, one at a time?"
No, stay on this one. But keep on going forward at 15-minute intervals. One person may have been left behind and may have made his way back to the instruments.
Fenestra shook his head and muttered something under his breath. The screen shifted again, and Doris said sharply,
"What's that?"
She was pointing. "I don't know. Noise."
"No, it's periodic. Could it be a single person's footsteps?"
"Sure, but it could be a dozen other things, too."
"It's coming along at about the time of footsteps, isn't it?"
Then, after a while, she said,
"Push it forward a little."
He did, and when the screen settled down, she said,
"Aren't those unevennesses getting bigger?"
"Possibly. We can measure them."
"We don't have to. You can see they're getting bigger. The footsteps are approaching the transducer. Go forward again. See when they stop."
After a while, Banastra said, "They stopped 20 or 25 minutes ago." Then cautiously, "Whatever they are."
"They're footsteps," said Doris with mountain-moving conviction. "There's a man up there, and while you and I have been fooling around here, he's collapsed, and he's going to freeze and die. Now don't say, 'Whatever they are, just call meteorology and get me Jannar Legan. Life or death, I tell you. Say so.'"
Banastra, lips quivering, had passed the stage where he could possibly resist anything this strange and passionate woman demanded. It took no more than 3 minutes to get Legan's hologram on the message platform. He had been pulled away from his dinner table. There was a napkin in his hand and a suspicious greasiness under his lower lip. His long face was set in a fearful scowl. "Life or death? What is this? Who are you?" Then his eye caught Doris, who had moved closer to Banastra so that her image would be seen on Jannar's screen. He said, "You again. This is simple harassment." Doris said,
"It is not. I have consulted Rogan Banastra, who is chief seismologist at the university. After you and your party had left Upperside, the seismograph shows clear footsteps of one person still there. It's my student Harry Selden, who went up there in your care, and who is now quite certainly lying in a collapsed stupor and may not live long. You will, therefore, take me up there right now with whatever equipment may be necessary. If you do not do so immediately, I shall proceed to university security, to the president himself if necessary. One way or another, I'll get up there, and if anything has happened to Harry because you delay 1 minute, I will see to it that you are hauled in for negligence, incompetence, whatever I can make stick, and will have you lose all status and be thrown out of academic life. And if he's dead, of course, that's manslaughter by negligence. Or worse, since I've now warned you he's dying."
Jannar, furious, turned to Banastra. "Did you detect?" But Doris cut in.
"He told me what he detected, and I've told you. I do not intend to allow you to bulldoze him into confusion. Are you coming now?"
"Has it occurred to you that you may be mistaken?" said Jannar, thin-lipped. "Do you know what I can do to you if this is a mischievous false alarm? Loss of status works both ways."
"Murder doesn't," said Doris. "I'm ready to chance a trial for malicious mischief. Are you ready to chance a trial for murder?"
Jannar reddened, perhaps more at the necessity of giving in than at the threat. "I'll come. But I'll have no mercy on you, young woman, if your student eventually turns out to have been safe within the dome these past 3 hours." 27. The three went up the elevator in an inimical silence.
Lagan had eaten only part of his dinner and had left his wife.